extend a warm greeting to our commencement speaker, Imam Khalid Latif. He is the executive director and chaplain for the Islamic Center at New York University. Imam Latif brings a unique perspective, serving also as a chaplain for the New York City Police Department, only the second Muslim ever to serve as a chaplain. He has also spoken at length about the challenges of being a Muslim in the West in the post-9/11 world. As an NYU graduate, he stood with his classmates in Washington Square Park and watched in disbelief as a second plane slammed into the World Trade Center. In his police chaplain's uniform, he attends the annual 9/11 memorial, and he has shared stages with Pope Francis and the Dalai Lama. But he also says he encounters suspicion and has been visited in his home by the FBI multiple times. In his words, getting on and off of planes is not really a fun experience. Fortunately, the US State Department, various institutions, corporations, mosques, and other communities in the United States, Canada, Denmark, the Netherlands, Spain, and Egypt have come to value Imam Latif's wise counsel. He is a highly sought after speaker, and we look forward to hearing his insights today.
I am now delighted to introduce Imam Khalid Latif, who will deliver this year's keynote address. Imam Khalid Latif is the university chaplain for New York University and executive director of the Islamic Center at NYU and a chaplain for the NYPD. He was appointed the first Muslim chaplain at NYU in 2005 and the first Muslim chaplain at Princeton University in 2006. Under his leadership, the Islamic Center at NYU became the first established Muslim student center at an institution of higher education in the United States. Imam Latif's exceptional dedication and ability to cross interfaith and cultural lines brought him recognition throughout New York City and elsewhere across the world. In 2007, Mayor Michael Bloomberg nominated Imam Latif to become the youngest chaplain in history of the New York City Police Department at the young age of only 24. Most recently, Imam Latif was selected as one of 60 New York City leaders to serve on Mayor Bill de Blasio's transition team. He was also appointed to a task force to combat hate by the New York City public advocate Tish James to deal with the rise in Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, and anti-Sikh sentiment in the city. In all he has done, Imam Latif has promoted a culture of valuing inclusiveness and diversity. He has worked tirelessly to foster dialogue and understanding across people and across faiths. For these reasons, he is a perfect embodiment of the values that underlie our school and our public health work. Please give a warm welcome to our keynote speaker, Imam Khalid Latif.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon. Oh, thank you. As was mentioned earlier in the ceremony, I had the distinct pleasure of sharing a stage with Pope Francis when he visited the United States a short time ago. It was arguably one of the most impactful meetings I've ever had in my life, to be in the presence of an individual who is so firmly drawn by a sense of value and conviction, something I'll carry with me throughout the rest of my days in this world. A lot of people, they ask me, what was it like to meet the Pope? For some reason, the question I got asked the most was, what did he smell like? So I don't know, he smelled pretty good. A week after he and I spoke together at the Ground Zero site in New York City, to an audience of about 400 people, city officials, 9/11 family members, faith leaders, and celebrities, but really a global audience in the millions if someone of the Pope's stature could command, I was speaking at Case Western University in Ohio, and a young woman there asked me, what was it like to meet the Pope? I said, you know, it was crazy. People lined up for hours, not even to hear this man speak, but just to watch his car drive by. People who had a deep relationship with Catholicism, people who had a tangential relationship with Catholicism, people who weren't even Catholic. They were just so moved by his message, and they wanted to be in his presence. I said, everything that he had spoken on that entire tour had been scripted, English not being his primary language, Spanish being his primary language. And the night before he and I spoke together at the Ground Zero site, he delivered a message at a well-known cathedral in New York City called St. Patrick's. There's about 3,000 people in attendance. For so many of them, this would be the highlight of their life. The night that they not only got to hear the Pope in person live, but for some of them, they got to shake his hand and get a hug from him. A night that they would tell their children about and their children's children about. And anything that would come out of this man's mouth, they would take as pure fact without any hesitation. I said that night, he started his remarks by going off script. And he first began by praying for 700 Muslims who had died that morning while performing a pilgrimage to Mecca. And I said to that young woman, why do you think he would do something like that? He's in the city where the 9/11 attacks took place. The relationship between Muslim community and governmental apparatus, quite hostile, tenuous at best. No one would have faulted him had he not done it. They wouldn't have said, I can't believe you didn't pray for those Muslims. He simply did it because he felt it was the right thing to do. This is a man who chooses to eat with the homeless rather than politicians. A man who asked his global constituency to take in Syrian refugees at a time when so many of the world's leaders, including elected officials in this country, were looking for every justification to keep them out. A man who understands his existence as being something much bigger than he himself. And where he can, without condition or qualification, be a resource to any, he would do so. And I think when you take that example and you juxtapose it with the unfortunate realities that we are bombarded with day in and day out today, that the news that you read is the same news that I read, and sometimes you can't even tell if it's new news or old news. Individuals so moved by egocentricity and arrogance, greed and selfishness, manifesting in racism, bigotry, and hatred, with no interest other than the serving of their own self-interest. And their ability to do so comes from segmenting and dividing us in ways that we buy into a certain antagonistic narrative of the other, that today, as you graduate from this place, you want to be able to realign to an understanding that says our deepest strengths are not when we are apart, but only when we come together in ways that we uniquely can. How you see people is not indicative of who they are. But how you see people will tell you a lot about yourself. And if you perceive somebody solely through the way that they dress, the color of their skin, whether they have a certain accent or not, the fundamental question you have to ask yourself is, why do you see it that way? Your organs of sensory perception, they are not limited to the eyes that you see with, the ears that you hear with, the tongues that you taste with, the hands that you touch with, even the minds that you think with. But you have a primary organ of cognition that will synthesize all of this information as it goes into you in various ways. And if you don't know why it's processing in the way that it is, it's just going to regurgitate the same challenges that we see day in and day out. Do you get what I'm saying? You don't get what I'm saying. I'll give you an example. I was speaking at MIT some time ago. There's about 500 or 600 people there. I took some of my students from New York University with me. And a young woman came up to me afterwards and she said, my sister's a really big fan of yours. Can I introduce her to you? And I said, sure. And she walked up to where I was standing, leading her sister all the way, arm in arm, because her sister was blind. She couldn't see. So we had a conversation for a few moments, and as we wrapped up, this young woman who was blind, she couldn't see, she said to me, you know, I thought you'd be a lot taller. I said, what? And she said, your voice, it's not coming from up here, but it's coming from down here. And I said, oh. And one of my students who was with me, he said, "Isn't that remarkable? She's blind and she could tell how short you are." And outside I said, "Oh yeah, that's so amazing." But inside I was thinking, "Man, how short am I? A blind woman just told me I'm short." She didn't need eyes to see. Do you understand? And sometimes we take the most simplistic level of understanding because all we're seeing is what it is that we see, but we're not getting to the depth of certain realities. And this is imperative to be able to reflect upon now, because in your work, you will have full opportunity to decide who it is that you will serve and who it is that you will not serve. And you have to ask yourself today, what will somebody need to look like for me to not be there for them? What color of skin will they need to have? What will the texture of their hair need to be? What part of the world will they need to come from so that my education, my training, my skills will not be used for their benefit? What allows for the perpetration of hate and bigotry in this world? The systematic and structural mechanisms that seek to just oppress through inequitous means are not those individuals who go out and perpetrate, but so many more of us who have the ability to do something about it, but we simply sit back and do nothing. In the last few months, I've stood at press conference after press conference and rally after rally in the wake of a rise of anti-bigoted, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-LGBTQ, anti-black, anti-Asian, anti-any minority that you could think of. And one of the hardest ones that I stood at was at a park in Brooklyn called Adam Yauch Park, named after one of the Beastie Boys. And we gathered there. There was celebrities, politicians, another Beastie Boy was there by the name of Ad-Rock. And we came together because somebody had vandalized a children's playground there with swastikas, the words, "Make America White Again" and "Trump." When I got on the microphone, I said to those people that that swastika represents to me the darkest potential of humanity. That you had people who were so motivated by their hate and bigotry that their entire objective was the annihilation of our Jewish brothers and sisters from this world. But it represents to me a second dark potential of humanity as well. That those individuals who sought to perpetrate that genocidal violence were only able to be successful because there were so many others who had the means to stop them, but just sat back and watched and did nothing. Where the line is drawn is not just on those who engage in acts of hatred and inequity and those who speak out against them, but individuals who are arguably just as bad as those who perpetrate that violence because they have the ability to do something, but they just sit back and watch. And the irony of today, when you sit wearing the same exact clothing as the people sitting around you, where you are probably more similar externally than you have ever been before to people who are different, the recognition has to come that there will be certain things that some of us go through that the rest of us will never see. And there's certain things that we will only have the ability to stop because of the unique power and privilege that we have been afforded to be able to serve those who are underserved and underprivileged. But that's an individual decision. And you have to start to think about it deeply from right now. And beyond the individual interactions on systemic levels, there are things that take place whether we recognize them or not. In the wake of a lot of hatred and bigotry, people have come to me and said, "What can we do to help you? Where is it that we can stand with you? How can we be a means of support? What can we do to help you heal?" And I say to them what I say to you, my brothers and sisters. I am not what is in need of healing, because I am not what is broken. You and I have to be the means now through which we remedy those things that actually need addressing. I work as a chaplain for the NYPD, as was mentioned. And one of the things that we do as police chaplains every year is attend the Ground Zero Memorial Service on September 11th. We start out by having breakfast with family members at police headquarters. We then take a bus down to the Ground Zero site and participate in the ceremony. And by rank, I'm an inspector. It's a fairly high rank, one rank below a one-star chief in this very military-esque institution. And on the 9th anniversary of the attacks, Vice President Biden was there. And we started the day as we normally would. There was a stage where the ceremony took place. In front of that, a VIP area for 9/11 family members, city officials, and others. Behind us, a press pit for the media to come and watch. And behind them, an area for the public to come and view. So while we're waiting for the ceremony to start, I'm in my police uniform, an inspector's uniform. I'm talking to people, we're waiting for things to get going. Three men approach me wearing suits and they say, Secret Service has spotted you from the top of a building. They want us to check your credentials just in case. I said, just in case what? He said, we're sorry we're doing this to you. I said, then why are you doing it? And to understand what they question at that moment is not merely my physical presence there, but the entire validity of my emotion tied to that space. Where I was an undergrad at New York University on September 11th in 2001. I stood with about 12,000 of my classmates in the middle of our campus in a park known as Washington Square as we watched the second plane fly into the towers. As Muslim students, we had no established chaplaincy at that time. We had to deal with so many things on our own. Media from all over the world was shoving microphones in our face because we were arguably the closest Muslim group to the Ground Zero site, and they wanted to know what do Muslims think. We dealt with a lot of backlash, a lot of hate. The very next day, a young woman tried to push me down a staircase. I stood at numerous funerals for people of my faith and other walks of life who died on that day. And so much of the work that I do until today is informed by the atrocities of that day. And in that moment, those men questioned the validity of all of it. And the frustrating thing isn't that I'm going through it, but what can I really do about it? That if I was to say anything in response, it would make the situation a lot worse for me. And so where I couldn't speak, and there was hundreds of people watching and they said nothing, there was a mother standing next to me who lost her son on September 11th. And she said to those men, what you are doing right now is more dishonoring to the memory of our loved ones that we lost on that day than anything else. That here this young man is standing with us in our moment of need, and you're making it seem as if he's doing something wrong just because he's Muslim. And as easily as they'd taken the validation away, she brought it right back. I share this with you for a few reasons. One, primarily, you want to understand somebody sitting somewhere concocted a policy that trickled down to those men that said, if you see somebody that looks like this, look at them again. I'm in a police uniform, man, an inspector's uniform. And even if I wasn't, it still wouldn't be okay. The reality is that numerous minority populations face in this country on systemic levels are things that we have to recognize so that we can stand against it with the best of everything that we have to offer. And I say this to you as somebody who has shared stages with the Pope and the Dalai Lama, been invited to speak with the president and his senior staff, not this president, the previous one. Don't get me wrong. I've been interviewed by every media outlet that you can think of. From Stephen Colbert to Katie Couric, been on the cover of Newsweek magazine. I've still had the FBI up in my house. And when I've asked them after a few times, what do you really want from me? They say, you're just too good to be true. Know that we're watching you. As was mentioned on before, getting on and off of planes is not a fun experience. I've probably been pulled off of more planes than most of you have flown on in your whole lives. The realities of being surveilled, profiled, and detained, I could tell you in deep detail, if that's happening to somebody who has my connections, what do you think is happening to others? And important to recognize, as a Muslim who comes from a South Asian background, born in this country in New Jersey and living in New York City, going through all of these things, I still couldn't tell you what it's like to be a black person living in this country. Now, if anyone was to ask me if I was to go through it all over again, I would say most definitely I would. Because for certain battles to be won, those battles have to take place in the first place. You might be the only one that is standing when everyone else is seated. You might be the only one that is speaking when everyone else is silent. But you might be that critical voice, that critical body that ignites what is needed for everyone else to get going. Don't hold back what it is that you have the unique ability to offer. And when you think about goodness and why you were given the degree that you have harnessed today, when you think about achievement and what it means to be a person who understands what really guides and motivates themselves, don't think about somebody wretched like me, but think about that mother who in that moment leveraged her power and her privilege to serve somebody who was underserved and underprivileged just because it was the right thing to do. Because who in their right mind would say something to a mother who lost her son on September 11th while she's standing at the Ground Zero site on September 11th? Nobody. And she knew this, and she used it just because she knew it was the right thing to do. That's the kind of goodness you want to be able to harness. Today, make an affirmation that your growth as you move forward on every tomorrow that you see will not be by understanding the other only through preconceived ideas and notions, but you will learn the stories of those that are different from you by actually being with them. To take time to understand that what it is that we are fed is not often what is reality. And the gain will not be only for those that will benefit from your presence, but your perspectives will broaden in ways that you can't even imagine. May your noble intentions be elevated and life's objectives be facilitated as you continue to do all that you do. May you be protected always from hearts that are not humble, tongues that are not wise, and eyes that have forgotten how to cry. May your successes of today be the first of many. And may you be granted more success on every tomorrow that you see. Go forward and be the reason that people have hope in this world, and never the reason that people might dread it. Congratulations, class of 2017. We are so proud of you and waiting to see what you will accomplish.
For these very inspiring and powerful words. I'm sure all of our graduates will remember them.